الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله
God, the beneficent, the merciful, the creator and sustainer of the universe, peace and blessings upon his servant and messenger Muhammad forever. Amin. I greet you with a greeting that is very common in Islam, Assalamu alaikum, which means peace be unto you. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid. Today we have our second program in our new series dealing with the economic system of Islam. We'll be discussing the topic of property rights in Islam. I have joining me, as usual, on the program, Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Could I have you very quickly touch on the main points that we discussed in our program number one in the our new series?
Okay. The first program was basically an introductory program. Some of the questions discussed include the common question as to what is the relevance of religion in the matter of economics, and we have indicated that economic behavior is part of the overall behavior or human behavior which is regulated by religion, and that applies to other religions as well, but in the case of Islam it's even more manifest, more clear. Secondly, we made a distinction between economics as a field of study which concentrate on the study of economic phenomena and trying to derive the laws regulating them, like the laws of supply and demand, for example, which is a more universal thing. And on the other hand, the definition of economic system. And we said that you could have different systems based on the kind of philosophy, objectives, and principles on the basis of which these systems can be established. We said that in both of these fields, or both of these aspects, Muslim jurists and scholars have made several contributions, and that preceded Adam Smith by nearly 1,000 years. As early as the 8th century, we find writings on economic system in Islam. We discussed briefly some of the problems in carrying through this type of research and applying or implementing these Islamic principles on a contemporary scene. And we have discussed some of the basic difficulties, such as the compilation of information from varieties of sources, in trying to really think hard and go back to the main sources of Islam, making a distinction between the conclusive texts and the interpretation, which may be subject to revision by qualified scholars. And finally, we looked briefly into some of the basic aspects of the methodology and principles in Islamic economics, and how these principles, broad as they may be, have deep-rooted and very strong influence on how the system is to be structured and operate.
Mm-hmm. Well, now turning to today's topic of property rights in Islam, I wonder if I could perhaps have you shed some light on the nature of the right to own property.
You see, the right to own property is an instinctive matter. It is something in our human nature as humans. It is related to the survival, self-preservation. However, throughout history, you find that the nature of that right and its limits have undergone certain changes. For example, in certain periods of history, the property right has been basically in the hand of a tribe, kind of common property. And by the way, this is not only history. For example, in Canada today, in some of the western provinces like Manitoba and Alberta, there's a particular Christian religious sect called the Hutterites, mm-hmm. who believe in this thing. They believe that they own the land jointly. Everything is owned jointly by the whole group, and they share the fruits altogether. In some cases, we find that this right has been restricted or narrowed down to properties which are common to one particular family. Mm-hmm. More developments resulted in the property right being recognized largely also in the hand of certain individuals. Of course, there might have been some overlap in those types of attitudes towards property. However, we can say that the nature and extent of property right is a matter which depended to a large extent upon the kind of philosophy or ideology which is common in any particular society at any particular time, basically as to how far you restrict the individual right of property or expand it, how much you give by way of rights for the society versus the individual.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, how does Islam stand on the extent of property right?
Well, before even just saying that it takes this position or that, I think it would be quite interesting to refer to a unique concept in Islam. That if you really look into the Quran, before even you get to the definition of my right or your right to property, it tries to put it first in the proper framework. In numerous verses in the Quran, we find that it gives us the clear indication that everything is owned by Allah, God, capital G. For example, one verse in the Quran says, لِلَّهِ مُلْكُ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ وَمَا فِيهِنْ. Unto God belongs the domain of heavens and earth and anything in between. In chapter 3, verse 26, قُلِ اللَّهُمَّ مَالِكَ الْمُلْكِ. Say, O Lord, the owner of the entire universe. So there are similar references like that in the Quran, which give us a clear indication that property or the right of ownership in the absolute sense belongs to God and to God alone, because He is the only one who owns the universe. But the admission of God as the owner of the universe does not mean that we as human beings, you and I, he and she, do not have also the right to own property. Yeah. It simply puts this individual right of ownership within the broader context. As was indicated last time, it is basically the ownership which is part of our responsibility as trustees of God on earth. Khilafat, the trusteeship, our responsibility here. The clear evidence in the Quran that there is no objection on the individual right of property within that particular framework are numerous. In, for example, in chapter 9, verse 104 in the Quran, it says, خُذْ مِنْ أَمْوَالِهِمْ. It's addressing the Prophet, take from their property, a charity or part that would be allocated for charity or social security, as you might call it today. So it uses the term, you know, their property, his property, showing that there is no contradiction between the ownership in the absolute sense, ultimate sense, in the hand of God, and our human, our right as human to own within these boundaries and to dispose of these properties and use them and benefit from them within the restriction that God has provided. Actually, this is not only in the Quran. We find that in the prophetic tradition, in the practice of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his companions and those who followed him also, shows clearly that property right is to be acknowledged and respected within this particular framework. And there are also different levels, you can say, of property.
Well, now, what is meant by types of property? Can you elaborate on that concept?
Well, one jurist divided that in a broader way by saying that there are certain things which are owned by God. Of course, the whole universe is owned by God, but it's owned by God, but no human being yet has had any access to this property. An example of this, you talk about Mars, for example. Yes. Nobody can say, oh, I own Mars or Jupiter.
Yes.
So it is created by God, but nobody had any access to it. But then there are certain properties which are owned by the entire human race, a common property of the human race. An example of that would be oceans, for example. Well, nobody can say, I own the Atlantic Ocean. Of course, you can claim certain shelf around your country, but nobody can claim ownership of the vast oceans. Within a given country or community or society, there may be also certain properties which are still the property of God, but it's owned jointly by the community at large. That's what is called in some countries, for example, like crown land, you know, the land which is not necessarily owned by any particular individual or corporation. And then there is the type of property which is in the possession of one particular individual or number of individuals, like a corporation, for example, or a family or whatever. This is, again, something that they own. However, they own it also within the duties and responsibilities which are imposed on this property and within the particular legal restrictions that Islamic law provides. So there are all types of property in that sense, in the level of this ownership. But all of them, of course, belong to God. It's just a matter of convenience of classification, really.
Well, now, you've made mention of restrictions. Can you give us some examples of these legitimate restrictions on property rights?
Well, these restrictions, by the way, are all non-excessive and non-reasonable, because under the term restrictions, various systems might take excuse and go into great length trying to restrict this basic instinctive right of property. So when we talk about restrictions here, we're talking about something not determined by you and me, but something that Islamic law or God's revelation has given some indication as reasonable restrictions. One of these restrictions, for example, is that the acquisition of this property should be through legitimate means. Of course, Islam recognizes the sanctity of property, the right to defend your property. But again, you should obtain this property through legitimate and lawful means. That's one reasonable restriction. Secondly, is that when you use your property or benefit from it, you have to use it in such a way that does not cause harm to other people. You have to keep that in mind. The concept of harm or darar in Islamic law is an interesting one. Let me just elaborate on it by indicating two angles of it. One basic rule established in one saying of the Prophet, la darara wa la darar, one should not harm himself or others, which means that, for example, if you have a piece of property or piece of land in the middle of a residential area, you can say, it is my property, I can do with it as I wish, and you just start building, let's say, a factory on it. As you know, in many countries, even today, there are some regulations concerning the so-called zoning. You can just have a big, noisy factory in the middle of places designated as a residential area. So in Islamic law, long time before these laws came into effect, just from the days of the Prophet, that principle has been already established. You cannot say that because I own certain property, I have the right to monopolize the basic necessities of people and keep hoarding or withholding basic needs like food or milk, and say, all right, you know, I decided not to sell and let people starve, for example. Another angle of this concept of harm, or avoiding harm in using your property, is a rule in Islamic law that says that private harm could be tolerated if it were necessary to, or if it was necessary to prevent a greater harm that would affect a larger number of people or affect the public at large. Just to give a very simple example rather than just the legal definition, suppose you have a house and it was decided that for the benefit of all, the road has to be widened in that particular area, or some important utility has to be established and there's no other way. Then in this case you don't say, it is my property. In this case you're entitled to a fair compensation for the benefit of all. And I think this is something, again, that is not uncommon today, but has been established long time ago in Islamic law. Another basic requirement also of considering restrictions on property is that the person can dispose of his or her property the way he or she likes, provided that the person also is mentally capable of doing this. In other words, if the person, for example, is insane, then for his own protection and protection of society at large, there must be some kind of trustee or guardian appointed on him. And I think, again, this is not unreasonable for his own benefit, to say the least. In addition to this also, one of the basic restrictions of property is not really a restriction as such, but rather that you're entitled to your property rights, provided that you also fulfill your duties and obligations emanating from your possession of that property.
Mm-hmm. Now, are these claims on property specified in, specifically in Islamic law?
There are certain things that, yes, are specified, and that would give us a clear indication on the nature of these obligations. But one obligation which we covered in some length in the previous series on social system in Islam is the obligation to maintain one's family, obligation to spend on one's wife and children, and in some cases, as we discussed before, relatives who are in need, depending again on the degree of closeness that we have detailed before. Another important duty on property is the payment of zakah, roughly translated as charity, but not charity really in the common sense or the common meaning of the term, that it is totally a voluntary thing. But zakah in Islam is something which is compulsory, which is required, both as an act of worship and obedience to God, so it gives us the spiritual element and the self control and the inner conscious of the individual being observant of his duty or her duty. But in addition to that, also it could be enforced actually in Islamic law if people are neglecting to pay their zakah. The minimum amount of zakah, or quote unquote charity, is 2.5%, but not of income. It is 2.5% of assets beyond the needs, the immediate needs of the individual, which has been there for a year. So it's not just a direct income tax, as we find, for example, in the more contemporary systems. Within that system, we find that there are certain parts of your property which are exempt or non-zakatable, if you will, not subject to the charity or zakat. This includes, for example, personal clothing, personal effects, your basic or primary residential home, your transportation means like car, your tools, if you have a particular profession that requires certain tools. But beyond this, if you have an extra that exceeds your needs and you have had that already for 1 year, then you have to pay zakah. And like I said, this is the minimum of 2.5%. There are some other types of zakah, for example, on agriculture, which go to 5%, 7.5%, and 10%. There are all kind of details that are involved in the nature of the payment. In other words, the basic needs of an average family are exempt from this zakah. But beyond that, that's a duty on the person to pay. In addition to this duty, or duties I should say, that we discussed, Islam also allows a just ruler or government to impose additional taxes beyond the minimum amount of zakah, or 2.5%, if the amount of zakah is not sufficient to meet the needs of society. In fact, one of the saying of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, narrated in At-Tirmidhi, he says, in property, there is a right or a claim beyond zakah. So zakah is just the minimum, but if the needs are there, like in the case of, for example, warfare, and the country is in bad need of additional funds, and the amount available is not enough, it could be imposed, but only, again, on those who can afford to make this contribution. If there is a famine, and the funds are all exhausted, or disasters that government funds are not enough, then additional levies or taxes would be permissible, provided, of course, there is good justification for it. So these are some of the rights required.
Well, now, you mentioned that for a property right to be recognized, property has to be acquired in a legitimate way. How does Islamic law define this legitimacy?
Okay, that's a good point, because we passed very quickly when we talk about the conditions or restrictions on property. You mentioned it rather quickly, but I think it's important to give some concrete examples and illustrations as to what really is called or regarded in Islamic law as legitimate source or means of acquisition of property, and what is regarded also as unlawful. One of the means or legitimate means of acquisition of property would be to own or possess something as a result of your own personal effort,
mm-hmm.
labor or work. This may include things such as working for a salary or wages, hunting, fishing, commercial operations or whatever. This would be one legitimate source, just an illustration of the nature of permissibility. Secondly, you could also own property on the basis not of your own labor, but on the basis of rights that has been given to you by Islamic law. Example, a wife, for example, is entitled by Islamic law for full maintenance, and the responsibility falls fully on the husband. So anything that he gives to his wife or maintain her, it is, again, her own property. She's free to take that if she gives her, for example, the marital gift, which the Quran mentions. It is exclusively her property. So even though she didn't earn it, she is entitled to hold that property or dispose of it. Another aspect within Islamic law also, or that gives the right of property, is inheritance. According to the law of inheritance of Islam, that you could discuss later, there are some interesting elements in it.
Mm-hmm.
You own property on the basis of inheritance. It's legitimate. Thirdly, we mentioned also early zakah, or charity.
Mm-hmm.
And if a person is unable to work, or poor, or disabled, he can own whatever is given to him by way of zakah or charity. A gift, receiving a gift, also is one causes of claim on this item or items as property. Exchange could be another source of property. Exchange of goods and services, or you might say exchange of utilities, you know, like barter system.
Mm-hmm.
Could be an example, would be one source also of property. That's one. Let's give also some illustration of the unlawful means of acquisition. To usurp the property of someone else without his or her consent would be regarded as unlawful, which would include things like theft,
mm-hmm.
Extortion, embezzlement of public funds. This all fall within this category. That's mm-hmm. unlawful in Islam. So you have no claim on that property if you're caught. In other words,
mm-hmm.
you can't say it's my property.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, even taking the property of other people with their approval, but through crooked means, which are forbidden in Islam, such as cheating or having a contract whereby you mislead the person or coax him or her into signing something which is unfair and you knew of it, just a kind of deception, that again make it unlawful. Gambling, all kind of gambling, you name it, whatever you talk about, government lottery, anything that involves gambling in some form or the other is totally illegitimate, and the property coming as a result of that is not regarded as halal or as lawful property in Islam. To gain property through unlawful type of labor or work, like the practice of sorcery or magic, prostitution might fall into that, to get money as a result of participating in a crime, if a person is hired as a hit person, for example,
yes.
you know, that income of course is regarded as totally unlawful. Bribery, for example, could be regarded as such. Likewise, gaining or acquiring properties through an unlawful contract like usury, or quote-unquote what you call today interest, is also regarded as unlawful. So I hope by these illustrations it becomes clear that the permissible and the forbidden are matters which are deeply ingrained and related to the basic moral teachings of Islam and its ethical orientation for the protection of every member in society.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, in addition to those legal aspects that we've been discussing, are there additional ethical directives related to property rights?
Yes, there are, beyond what is required or could be enforceable, even though in a way, in Islamic law, you can say that the legal and the ethical are rather intermingled. They're really interrelated. But I think it would be a good idea also to look at it also from that angle. But one of those ethical teachings is the restrictions in Islam or discouragement of hoarding. Hoarding, I'm not talking here about saving a little bit for the rainy day like some people do. This is permissible to take some slush funds for, you know, for emergencies or possible future needs. If you want to buy a car and you don't want to buy it on interest or something and you want to save a little by little until you're able to buy, there's no problem with that. But what Islam really speaks of against quite forcefully is hoarding wealth in a sense of keeping wealth away from circulation. For example, in chapter 9, verse 34 in the Quran, it says that those who hoard gold and silver and don't spend in the way or the path of God, give them the news of a severe punishment. And then it talks about their punishment in the Day of Judgment. Now, this is not just a matter of ethical teaching. It has also a deeper economic implication. Because when people withhold wealth, they don't use it. I'm not saying that they have to spend it all by way of charity, but do not invest this excess funds that they have. Then even from the point of view of the modern economics, it is harmful to society because you're keeping wealth from circulation, and as such you're not really contributing much to the enhancement of economic activities which may be needed to provide jobs for others and harness the various natural resources available.
Yes.
That's one thing. Another ethical teaching that Islam deal with is the prohibition of excess expenditure or being too excessive or exuberant in spending. But in the meantime, it also condemned miserliness. One beautiful verse in the Quran, in chapter 17, particularly in 29, it says, "Don't get your hand close to your neck," which is just like a metaphor of being too miserly, "and don't extend it all the way," which is also a metaphor or allegory of being too wasteful in your spending. So there should be some kind of moderation. In chapter 7 in the Quran, verse 31, it says, وَكُلُوا وَشْرَبُوا وَلَا تُسْرِفُوا إِنَّهُ لَا يُحِبُّ الْمُسْرِفِينَ, that eat and drink, but don't be wasteful or too excessive because God doesn't like those who go to excesses. So this is another aspect that pertains perhaps to the question of property. A third teaching pertaining to property is the obligation not to leave key resources available to the community idle. And just to give you an illustration of this, one saying of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, he said that a person who reform land, like if you have a barren land, for example, and a person reform it, he has the right to own it. But if he does not make it productive or use it for 3 years, then it would be taken away from him. If he uses it and then later on neglect it for 3 years, without using it and making productive, it could be taken away from him so that somebody else can make use of these resources available to the community. So, in other words, when you look at the basic notion of property as it relates to the ethical framework or the principle and philosophy of Islam, you find that it stands really in a moderate way between the right to own property without any qualification and between the right of having a totalitarian system whereby you own very little and some few bureaucrats claim that they are controlling the property for the sake of everyone. There is some kind of moderate way of acknowledging the right of individual property while maintaining also the interest of society and above all the moral and ethical obligation in mind.
Well, we'll stop at that point with our second program in our series. We want to invite you back next week when we'll continue with our third program in the series dealing with the economic system in Islam. Thank you for watching. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.
Yeah.